What goes on behind the scenes in Pacific politics and how does it affect us? Each week, Politalk dives straight into the tough questions, like who is actually stepping in to save people from sorcery accusation violence in Papua New Guinea?
So she was gasping for air inside the people in a group there, and then they accused her, like, you must be the sorceress.
To listen, search Politalk in your favorite podcast app.
This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, I'm Evan Wasuka, and welcome to Pacific Review, where we'll be taking a look at the big stories from the Pacific region over the past week. Coming up on the show, a ship busted with 5 tons of cocaine in French Polynesia is heading towards Sydney, and it's not clear if Australian authorities can stop it. There's anxiety in Bougainville over a secret deal to reopen the Panguna mine. And Solomon Islands trials a new bus service for school kids. We'll have more on those stories coming up. Pacific Review comes to you from the lands of the Boonwurrung and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. But first, the MV Raider was intercepted carrying almost 5 tons of cocaine near French Polynesia a fortnight ago. The French Navy responded by dumping the illicit cargo overboard and then sent the crew and the ship on its way towards Sydney. As Lucy Cooper reports, Australian authorities are staying tight-lipped about whether they're planning to take any action of their own.
Making its way to Sydney, the MV Raider and its crew is travelling light after it was intercepted near French Polynesia and the 5 tons of cocaine found on board was dumped at sea by French authorities. In a catch and release, the vessel and its crew sailed away unopposed. French Polynesian President Moitai Brotherson says overcrowding in prisons is why the crew couldn't be held there. The country's customs director, Serge Pasetti, said it's an operational realism.
By destroying the drugs immediately, we deliver the harshest blow to the cartels, a direct financial loss. And our priority is to neutralize the drugs to financially strangle criminal organizations. No one escapes justice in the long run.
Whether the crew will be investigated and which jurisdiction is responsible isn't straightforward.
Narcotic smuggling is not a universally recognised crime.
Maritime law expert Jennifer Parker says Australia has no jurisdiction to take action.
It wasn't in Australian waters. It's not an Australian flag vessel. Australian naval members didn't detain them. So you would have to get a pretty high-level agreement between the two countries for us to take them and prosecute them. In terms of whether Australia should be tying up our own taxpayer dollars in our own court prosecuting drug smuggling crimes that occur on the high seas, no, I wouldn't think so.
Ms. Parker says if the ship was intercepted in international waters, as French authorities say, what happens on board the vessel is the responsibility of the flag state. In this case, West African country, Togo.
It's changed its flag from the US flag to the Togo flag, which is a known flag of convenience. Flags with lower oversight that are often used to hide criminal activities.
That's Noam Rabinovich, the director of product marketing at Winward, a maritime AI company which put the vessel on the radar of authorities before it was intercepted.
The radar had been dormant for a long time, for a couple of years, and then suddenly reappeared in Honduras and then changed its identity. It then changed its pattern of life. It began operating in a way that didn't match its historical profile, like a first-time visit to the Panama Canal. So that change in behavior prompted our Windward system, our AI models, to flag the vessel as risky for smuggling.
A spokesperson for the Australian Federal Police did not provide a comment on the location of MV Raider or whether it is responsible for interception and detainment of its crew, but says that the AFP will continue to work with domestic and international law enforcement partners to bolster our shared future capture and combat the threat of organised crime. Steve Simon, chair of New Zealand's Ministerial Advisory Group on Transnational, Serious and Organised Crime, says recent illicit drug seizures and discovery of narco subs suggest unprecedented amounts are making their way to Australia and New Zealand.
The volume of drugs that are coming through and the profits to be made from them are so high that unless we can reduce the markets in New Zealand and Australia, the demand will result in those drugs coming some way or other through the Pacific.
He thinks Australia could do more.
If I use the analogy of the old game battleships, we can get together our different pieces and try and block out these superhighways for drugs coming down through the Pacific to our countries.
Back in French Polynesia, Serge Pasetti says cooperation is key.
What is most important in sharing information with all the services? We trust between the French customs and the Australian customs are never been higher.
French Polynesia Customs Director Serge Pasetti ending that report from Lucy Cooper. Plans to reopen the Panguna mine on Bougainville are causing anxiety on the island, which is still grappling with traumas of the past. It's one of the world's largest copper deposits, potentially worth tens of billions of dollars. Many locals are hoping it'll bankroll independence from Papua New Guinea. Panguna was also the epicenter of a bloody decade-long civil war, and the Bougainville government's out-of-the-blue announcement it'll partner with an Indian mining company to reopen it has caught people off guard. The ABC's PNG correspondent, Marion Farr, with this report.
On the island of Bougainville, Raphael Evenu still remembers the violent civil war that claimed up to 15,000 lives 3 decades ago. As a young man during the conflict, he says he was thrown in jail by Papua New Guinean soldiers.
Oh, it was horrible. Awful. Took our rights away and then everything.
Central to the crisis was Panguna, one of the world's largest open-cut mines at the time. But in 1989, it was forced to close as tensions broke out over benefit sharing, foreign workers and environmental concerns. Now, more than 30 years later, that mine appears to be on a rapid path to reopening, and Mr. Evenu is worried about a lack of consultation.
We want to help the government, but at the same time, on the same token, we must be consulted.
Panguna has one of the world's largest copper deposits, and the Bougainville government wants to use the mine to bankroll its ambitions to become an independent nation by next year. At the moment, the autonomous region generates just 5 to 6% of its revenue internally, relying on Papua New Guinea for the rest. But Panguna could change that, with the mine expected to generate $40 billion if it's reopened. Oliver Nobertau is Project Director of the Australia-Papua New Guinea Network at the Lowy Institute.
So in order to achieve those independence aspirations, they need this economic injection.
But concerns have been raised over how negotiations are being handled. In November, the Bougainville government signed a secretive deal with Indian mining company Lloyds Metals and Energy Limited, agreeing to partner on the Panguna development. That came as a surprise to Panguna landowner Philip Miriori.
We have not been consulted on the whole development of reopening of Panguna mine.
Bougainville Copper Limited, the company that owns the Panguna exploration licence, says it also wasn't informed about the deal. It was running a separate process to identify a development partner and had chosen CMOC, a Chinese mining company, as its first choice. But 2 weeks ago, the government, which owns a majority share in Bougainville Copper, directed the company to abandon negotiations with CMOC and pursue a partnership with Lloyds Metals instead. This week, two long-serving members of the Bougainville Copper Board handed in their resignations. For Oliver Nobertau, it's a sign of growing tensions.
It seems to be sort of irreconcilable differences that are causing board members to leave.
He wants to know exactly how and why Lloyds Metals became the government's pick.
But this should be a question for other Bougainvillians as well, more so when we're talking about good governance and transparency as to how this decision was made.
The Bougainville government, Lloyds Metals and Bougainville Copper have not responded to the ABC's questions. Oliver Nobertau is urging them all to tread carefully, given the tragedies of the past.
This is the exact concern that a lot of people have. If this is not managed well, could this lead to more conflict on the island?
A fear that no one wants to see realised.
That report from Marion Farr and Thekla Gunga. The United States government has issued travel bans against two senior Pacific politicians over corruption allegations. Palawan Senator Hokkon Bawal has been accused of taking bribes from Chinese businesses, while Anderson Jibas is accused of siphoning funds for victims of U.S. nuclear testing. Both men have soundly rejected the allegations, which was made by the U.S. State Department. The ABC's Finau Fonua with more.
The statement issued by the U.S. State Department accused Mr. Jibas of allegedly stealing U.S. taxpayer funds meant for victims of nuclear weapons testing and announced that he would be barred from entering the U.S. But he told the ABC the allegations are false and that if they were true, he would have been charged by Marshallese authorities.
I haven't done anything wrong. That's why the Marshall Island government is not doing anything to me. They have been auditing our office. We have financial CFOs. We have the trust managers. We have the trustees that work with us. I mean, that's why there is nothing happening to me here in the Marshall Islands.
During his term as mayor of Bikini Island, a $70 million plus U.S.-funded Bikini Resettlement Trust Fund almost went dry. But Mr. Jibas says there isn't any evidence to support the U.S. allegations.
I think it's unfair to the fact that there's no proven allegations or documents on that kind of information to be let out and be spread to the public.
However, Gift Johnson, editor of the Marshall Islands Journal, says an audit of one of the years during Mr. Jibas's term indicates that finances were misused or badly managed.
The Bikini Resettlement Trust Fund, which was used for decades by the Bikini local government to support their community in exile, was wiped out under Mayor Jibas.
Mr. Johnson says further audits are expected this year.
At that point, we'll have a much clearer picture of where, you know, like what happened to money, how it was spent, and what the auditors have to say about it. But what is a fact is the trust fund, the Bikini Resettlement Trust Fund, went from about $70 million down to nothing.
However, Mr. Jibas says he's done no wrong and is hopeful the U.S. State Department will reverse its decision.
We also follow the democracy laws like the U.S., but some people are not happy. And I think what the State Department did is wrong, and we hope that sometime in the near future that can be corrected.
And that was former mayor of Bikini Island, Anderson Jibas, and Finau Fonua with that story. Papua New Guinea is heading towards national elections next year, and there are warnings that the integrity of the vote could be at risk. The latest Corruption Perception Index from Transparency International saw PNG's score drop by 4 points, renewing concerns about corruption and the declining trust in government institutions. The Chief Executive Officer of Transparency International PNG, Ariane Kasman, says there are laws to tackle corruption, but they're not being enforced. On next year's election, she says the government needs to start planning now to reduce the risk of electoral fraud that has plagued previous polls.
While there are efforts to try to look at addressing corruption, our biggest challenge is really look at the enforcement of existing laws, enforcement of, right across our land. And it's not just looking at the space of elections. It's also concerning when we look at the upcoming FATF grey listing as well. So I think for Papua New Guinea, it is really time for government to be serious about how we protect our integrity institutions and make sure that they are strong enough to fight or address corruption here in the country.
And I know you mentioned a little bit in regards to, you know, where it seems to maybe just dip when it's sort of heading into a national election year. But is there anything you can really say, particularly, what is it risky for public institutions during this period?
I think it's always difficult. What we're seeing overall globally for the CPI, there is an observed trend that democracies tend to have less corruption. Strong democracies tend to have less corruption and vice versa. Democracy is weaker in countries with more corruption. And so the risks there for us are that, you know, if we don't take action, if we're not enforcing laws, if we're not ensuring that people are held to account and that people are prosecuted for acts of corruption, corruption, we are going to see a continued deterioration of our CPI score.
Ariane, when we talk about transparency, you know, they had actually warned similar issues emerged during the last election. So then what impact did that have on the integrity of the vote?
I think for the 2022 elections, there was a lot of discussion around what needed to be done, but not enough action was taken. Then we saw the 2022 elections happen, and unfortunately, again, by far one of the best one of the worst elections we have seen for the country. And so there was an immediate action taken by government to put in place a parliamentary committee, look at how we could address some of the reforms that needed to be put forward. Unfortunately, that parliamentary committee, when they had submitted their report to parliament, had not gotten their report adopted. And so no reforms had been taken up. And so we're stuck in a situation where potentially there could be rushed reform before the elections, which again just poses greater risks for a country like ours. And so focus really needs to be on making sure that the electoral roll is updated in preparation for 2027 national general elections, making sure that the Electoral Commission is properly funded and supported to be able to carry out the pre-election preparation, and just making sure that especially law enforcement agencies, those that are needed to work together to address the election preparedness, are also effectively nationally coordinating together, and also budgetary support is provided for them as well. So there are steps that we can take to actually help to improve the integrity of our elections, but the work actually has to start now.
Yeah, I was just going to ask, is there still time for the government and authorities to act, and what concrete steps needs to happen right before polling day?
Yeah, look, there is time. First of all, making sure that there is a permanent appointment of the Electoral Commissioner so that the work can really take place. So make sure it's implemented, the plan of the PNG Electoral Commission is implemented this year. Secondly, would be making sure they fund the role update and making sure that it's transparent. So Electoral Commission will have to make sure that it's displayed as per the law and that people are able to update the electoral roll, check their names if they've moved. And then third, it's really looking at national coordination. There is a body called the Interdepartmental Elections Committee that's chaired by the Chief Secretary. They've already started their regular meetings. So just making sure that everyone that's supposed to be at that meeting is participating and is making sure that they are providing regular updates to strengthen our election preparedness. And then lastly, more importantly, like anything else, there is funding that is required. So annual budgetary support must be given to Electoral Commission agencies involved in election preparedness, including our law enforcement agencies such as the Police, Defence Force and the Correctional Service.
Chief Executive Officer of Transparency International PNG, Ariane Kussman, speaking there to the ABC's Aggie Tupou. They're big, bright and yellow, and they're the pride of Solomon Islands capital, Honiara, where a public school bus trial is underway, and already it's making life easier for parents and students. The ABC's reporter in Honiara, Chris Enrita Omani Leong, went along for the first ride of the new service.
It's 7 a.m. in Honiara's central market, often the busiest time at the city centre, as workers, students and parents rush to board the public buses. Today, it's slightly different.
For me as a parent,
it brings me peace of mind, and I am happy that there is no longer that experience of struggling to get on a bus. It's a stressful daily experience at the bus stops when I drop off my children or when I have other things on and I'm running late.
That's Karen Evans, a mom travelling on the school bus with her child. It wasn't only the parents, though, who were fans of the new bus service. So too were the students.
My name is Elena.
And your name?
My name is Polly.
Okay. What do you think about this, just having a school bus and being able to get on one this morning?
I think it's better to come for the school bus because it's easy for us. But every morning we fight for the bus to get to school.
Yeah, awesome. And yourself?
The same.
Yeah. You think it's a good thing to be able to have a school bus?
Yes.
You get to school on time?
Yeah, and safe.
In Honiara, public buses are owned by businesses and private individuals. Infrastructure Minister Ricky Fuo says having dedicated bus service run by the city council was something the city clerk wanted.
I asked what the leftover buses were doing, I mean, the ones that were left over after the games. And he said that they only use them normally when they have events, such as big meetings, or if the country is hosting a particular group or an event, then they use that bus for logistics. But otherwise, it just sits there. So, and then that's where the whole idea, like, all right, why don't we use these buses instead of having them sit here? Why don't we turn them into school buses? We sprayed them. We said, look, let's make it look like a school bus. So we sprayed it in yellow.
It's unclear how long the trial will go for. In the meantime, students are paying $2 for a ride on the big yellow bus. Minister Fuo says there'll be a study into the trial, and in 2 years' time, students could possibly have free access to the buses.
It's a mission for myself and the ministry that before, it can be next year, it can be the year after that, but before 2028, we definitely, the kids are going to have free transport to school in the school buses. You know, cost of living is very high at the moment, and so we thought, like, if we could save a parent $10 a day per child, that's $50 per child a week. That's, you know, you times that by 52 weeks in a year, or I mean, school weeks are what, 40? You times that by a year, and then, you know, that's a big chunk of money that the parents are saving where they can spend a bit more on their children.
Rex Konofilia from the Honiara City Council says they're excited about the new service.
What then this will committee decide for?
Our committee has decided that the buses will only travel on the main road of Honiara. The routes are from the Central Market, which is the main bus station, to White River and back, and then from the Central Market to Burns Creek.
So how did the yellow buses perform on their first day of service? Well, for parent Karen Evans, she was impressed with the service and happy with the $2 fare. Well, for parent Karen Evans, she was impressed with the service and happy with the $2 fare.
It's affordable because some of the public buses we usually get on cost more even for a short distance. And so with this, we are able to save money.
And that was Honiara mom Karen Evans speaking there to the ABC's Chris and Rita Manu Leong about the big yellow school bus in Honiara. And finally to sports, the new Super Rugby Pacific season starts this weekend. And in the Pacific, all eyes will be on Fiji's Churchill Park, where the Fijian Drua and Moana Pacifica will face off. It's going to be a crucial year for both teams, but Moana will be adapting to life without its superstar captain, Adi Savea, while the Drua will be under pressure to raise their game to reflect Fiji rugby's rise to Tier 1 status. But the New Zealand Herald's rugby analyst Gregor Paul says the Drua have one very obvious problem, and that's how to win a match outside of Fiji.
Hardy put the team on his shoulders last year, and he dragged them through tough situations. He inspired them. He elevated them. He probably produced the single greatest Super Rugby campaign we've ever seen by one individual, and he's a pretty special player at that. So that's not available to them in this campaign. So clearly, they're going to be disadvantaged by that. But I guess if you're Moana, you're hoping that some of what he brought last year in terms of improving training cultures, habits, instilling better discipline on and off the field, setting the team up to succeed, they'll be hoping that some of that stuck to a young, inexperienced team that didn't have a lot of professional experience. But they're clearly not quite the same team without him.
But if Moana are hoping for a miracle, they've got one. He's the new captain, Miracle Faialangi. I mean, it's a big task for a relatively inexperienced player to take on.
Yeah, love your pun. Yeah, look, he's a good player, though. And I think that's to the point I was making previously. There is an opportunity for a number of guys, Miracle being the most obvious, to fill the vacuum in terms of leadership, ability on the field, driving the club off the field. There's an opportunity for some young-ish guys who don't have a lot of experience to follow in Ardi's footsteps and take his lead. Like, he's been a player with considerable potential. We all know that. He's had some pretty good games. But I don't think he's slung together a campaign yet that we've all looked at and gone, wow, this guy is an international player. He can go onto the world stage and light up next year's World Cup. I think that's his chance to do it, be inspirational, and drag a few players along with him.
What about the question of where Moana play their home games? My understanding is that they've virtually been told you will only play so many in Auckland.
Look, it's been a challenge from day one, finding a home for Moana. There's a difficulty here in Auckland. It's a crowded sports market, not by Australian standards, possibly, not by Melbourne standards, certainly, but it's a crowded market sporting-wise. Certainly the Blues welcomed the concept of Moana, but didn't really like the idea of having a Pacific club plonked on their doorstep, partly because the Blues see themselves very much as a Pacifica club. So that's been a perennial issue, that there's been tension placed on them around, can they build a fan base in Auckland?
Gregor Paul, rugby analyst with the New Zealand Herald, and you're speaking there to the ABC's Richard Ewart. And that brings us to the end of Pacific Review for this week. I'm Evan Wasuka. Thank you for your company, and do join us again at the same time next week for more news and views from across the Pacific.